I want to talk for a moment in terms of relationships about nourishing and toxic people in their relationship to self-esteem. How many of you know people in life, when they walk into a room, everyone else kind of leaves, you know? Or that if you spend time with these people, after about an hour, you feel totally drained, like you want to go to bed. I sometimes call these people like black holes of the universe. You know, they suck energy. They're like energy vampires, okay? And how many of you know people that when they walk into the room, the whole world brightens up? It's always kind of interesting to ask yourself, what kind of person are you, right? But the key here is that we have what we call nourishing and toxic people in life. Nourishing and toxic people. And if you want to increase your self-esteem, hang out with nourishing people. I was doing a seminar recently, and a woman shared with me that she didn't like to go home for Christmas. And I said, why do you go home then? She said, because it's expected of me. I said, what happens there? She said, I can't stand my in-law. She said, I love my mother-in-law, and I love my mother, but I can't stand my husband's brothers and sisters. And we go there for 2 or 3 days. Everyone puts everyone down. They're competitive. They're negative. I don't like to be around it. I said, well, don't go. She said, I have to go. I said, no, you don't. She said, but then my mother-in-law will be hurt. I said, here's the deal. Call her up and say, look, I'll make up her name and say, Agnes, look, here's the deal. I don't want to come for Christmas this year because I can't stand all the other people that are there. They're negative and they put each other down. But I love you. So I'm wondering if maybe about a week after Christmas, we'll come over for a weekend, we'll bring the kids, and we'll get together as a family, and just be with you, because I love being with you. I don't want to be with those other people. Do you think she'd understand? She said, well, yeah, she might even think that was kind of nice, that I wanted to be with her that much. See, you don't have to go home for Thanksgiving. If when you go home, like when I go home, sometimes my mother is like, I'm still 6 years old. She wakes me up to watch cartoons on Saturday morning. You know, come on, it's time. Mom, I'm tired, you know. And then she starts in on me. You do this, you do that. You say you're a psychologist. You don't even love your own mother, you know. And on she goes. And, you know, that's not fun for me. So I started just not going, you know. And then my mother started saying, well, how come you don't come home? And I told her. I said, when I feel like I'm around you, I don't feel nourished. Now, my mother has started to change her behavior. She's a beautiful lady. But for a long time, it was a toxic relationship for me. Another thing I found that really helped me with my mother was the idea that when I was resisting her negativity, she would push on me and I'd say, no, I'm not. And she'd say, yes, you are. And I'd say, no, I'm not. And we'd get into this struggle and I'd be defending myself. And one day, I was watching an Aikido demonstration, which is a martial art, like judo. And the whole principle in Aikido is you don't resist energy coming at you, you blend with it. So if someone's swinging at you, you just kind of move to the side and keep kind of pushing their arm forward, and you just get out of the way. And so I started to apply that principle to my relationship with my mother. She'd start to say, you know, you're really a bad son, you never call. And I'd say, you know, if I was you, I'd feel the same way. You know, I probably am a bad son. Then there'd be this long silence on the phone. And then she'd say, well, you're not that bad. And I found that if I stopped resisting people judging me and criticizing me and just agreed with them, that they had nowhere to go because all of their energy was defending their point. And if I just said, well, I can understand how you'd feel that way, then invariably they'd stop and start to focus on the other. It's a very strange phenomenon, but I find that it works anytime people are in kind of a conflict situation with me. If I don't resist them and I just agree with them, then they stop attacking me, and then usually they're open to listening to my point of view. When I say agree with them, I'm not saying that they're right, and I'm saying that I understand how they could have that perception. I understand how they could feel that way, but I'm not saying they're right. But I still internally inside of me know that I have my point of view and my perception of who I am, and that's right too. It's almost as if we can both be right, that there is no truth out there. There's only your experience of me and my experience of me. And I choose to believe my experience of me while I let you have your experience of me. All self-esteem is created in relationship, okay? So I have relationships with people at work. I have relationships with people that I'm in personal, intimate contact with, my family and so forth. And if you want to have high self-esteem, one of the easiest ways to start building that is to surround yourself with nourishing people, to literally start avoiding toxic people. If people at work are toxic, don't eat lunch with them. You don't have to eat lunch with them if that's the reality. You don't have to go where toxic people are. Start putting yourself in an environment with nourishing people. It's very important for self-esteem. Another aspect in this relationships idea and getting support is what we call mentors. It's important if you're going to be successful in life to have mentors, people that you look up to who know more than you know about what you're interested in, and get yourself apprenticed to them. I used to work for a man named W. Clement Stone, self-made multimillionaire, and he used to say, go out and hang around successful people if you want to be successful. You've got to find people in your company, in your field, that know more than you. Write them a letter. Call them up. Say, look, I'd like to have lunch with you. You are doing what I want to do. You are a role model for me. I'd like to share with you. I'd like you to share with me. Would you be willing to do that? And 9 times out of 10, people say yes. It's flattering to be considered a role model, to be considered someone that people would like to learn from. So give yourself permission to do that. How many of you saw the movie Bambi? Any of you read the book or see the movie Bambi? You remember the scene in Bambi where it shows the two deer that are sitting on two opposite ends of this clearing, and they're looking across the clearing, and the young deer looks at this older deer and he says, wow, look at that older deer. Incredible. He's so old. He's got all those antlers. My God, he'd know so much. I'd learn to survive in the woods. He'd teach me, you know, where to eat in the winter and how to avoid getting shot by the hunters. I could learn so much from him. Gosh, I'd love to talk to him. But why would he want to talk to a young deer like me? I don't know anything. And on the other side of the clearing, you hear this. The old deer looks over at the young deer and he says, wow, look at that young deer. So fresh and unjaded and full of life and love. I'd love to talk to him. I'd learn so much about, you know, being young again and having vitality and seeing things in a new way. But why would he want to talk to me? I'm just an old washed out deer. See, how many times do we do that in our life where we want to connect, we want to reach out, but we stop ourselves, we don't let ourselves. So give yourself permission to reach out and get involved with people. And finally, in this whole area of mentorship, have the intelligence, if you will, the wit, to take seminars, go to workshops, listen to tapes, read books. But seminars and workshops are critical because what you're going to do is meet other people like you. Like those of you sitting here in the room today, if you would really get to know each other, you'd probably all like each other a lot because you came to something that had a similar interest for you. And if you want to meet people who are doing things and interested in the kind of things you are interested in, take workshops and you'll meet other people, professionals, friends, and so forth. Okay, I'd like to look at another aspect of building self-esteem, a principle that'll really work in your life. And it's adopting the attitude that I'm 100% responsible for everything that I experience and that happens in my life. 100% responsibility. The idea that no one else is in charge, but you're in charge. We've got to quit blaming others. We've got to quit complaining. And I use a little formula called E plus R equals O. The E stands for the events in your life, the things you experience. The R is your response to those events. And the O is the outcome, what shows up as the result of the E plus R. And everything in your life that you like or don't like is an outcome of some earlier response to the way things were in your life. Like when people go to therapy or to counseling or to talk to a friend, they complain about something. They're always complaining about an outcome. If they say, I got fired, I'm not happy, I've got an ulcer, that's an outcome of a previous response to the way things were. And if you think of this formula, E plus R equals O, it's kind of like mathematics, 2 plus 2 equals 4. And if you don't like the outcome that you have in your life, if you don't like how it is, financially, physically, interpersonally, whatever it is, you've got to go back and change something in the formula. Because if 2 plus 2 equals 4, and you don't like 4, and the E is called the way the world is, then your only way of changing that outcome is to change your response. And so that's your point of power.
Really, all of our power is in our ability to respond. The word responsibility comes from the ability to respond. What I really mean by that is that in any given situation, the only thing I can do is what my action is. I can respond to you in a certain way or I can respond in another way. And by changing my responses, experimenting with different ways of responding, I begin to discover that each way of responding produces a different result. And that some ways are producing results that I like, some ways produce results that I don't. I have the power at any given time to change my behavior. And in changing my behavior, the outcome will always be different because it's always a mathematical equation of what you do
plus what I do equals the outcome. See, I'm not powerful enough to change you. I can attempt that. I mean, that's one response. But usually my point of power is changing my own reaction, changing my own response. And then I can produce the outcome I want. It may take 5 or 6 experiments to see what that's going to be. I might find that yelling at you doesn't work, and inviting you doesn't work, but teasing you into it works, or being humorous works. How many of you have ever blamed the traffic for being late to work? Anyone ever do that? Yeah. See, that's like blaming the event for the outcome called I was late. When the reality is, if you've lived in Chicago or LA or New York or most big cities, you know that you have traffic jams. Okay. No one ever says, you know, I left too late. They always say the traffic made me late. See? The weather made me late. My kids made me late. Someone else. It's always the E. See, and somehow in life we want to blame the E. We want the E to change. If only the E would change, then my life would be better. Do you ever hear people say things like, if only we had a different administration in the White House, if only I had more money, if only my boss understood these kind of things we're talking about in the seminar today, if only my wife would take Marriage Encounter, boy, then we'd really have a great relationship. So it's always like something out there. We want it to change. How many of you in the room are married or have been married? Can I see a show of hands? About 3/4 of the people. Raise your hand again if you got married or were in a relationship and thought, this is a pretty good catch, pretty good person, but there's one or two little things about them I'd like to change. Let's see a show of hands? Almost everybody. Now keep your hand up if you were able to get them to change that thing about themselves. No hands up in the room, see? They don't usually change. In fact, as we get wiser, we realize we need to change. We need to become more accepting and so forth. We need to change our response because the world just is the way the world is, okay? And if it rains on your birthday, you don't have to take it personally. It's just doing what it does. Would it be possible to come into this room with about 30 or 40 people in here and leave at the end of the day feeling lonely? Would that be possible to do? Sure. Would it also be possible to come into the same room, same people, same temperature, same barometric pressure in the universe, same astrological configuration in the sky, and leave here feeling connected to people? So you could produce both of those results in the same room with the same people. So it's not the people. What happens is what you do. See, some people come into the room, they sit down, they look to the right, and they go, oh, I don't want to talk to her. She looks too old. I don't like old people. They look to their left and they go, I don't want to talk to him. He's got a crew cut. Looks like military. I never liked military people, so I don't want to talk to him. And instantly they look around the room and they start eliminating everybody as a possibility to speak to. Right? Then they go home and they say to their wife or their husband, they say, you know, I went to that workshop with Jack Canfield. Boy, what a group of unfriendly people. Nobody reached out to me the whole day. Someone else comes in, they sit down, they look to the right, they say, hi, my name is Jack Canfield, or whatever their name is, and where are you from, and what do you do? And pretty soon they're connected to 2 or 3 people. It's not the group. It's not the people. See, it's how you respond to those people. See, a lot of times people are so afraid of rejection. And if I were to ask someone here to go to lunch with me, and she were to say no, did I have anyone to go to lunch with before I asked her? No. Did I have anyone to go to lunch with after I asked her?
No.
So it didn't get worse, did it? It stayed the same. See, one of the things is when you get rejected, it doesn't get worse. It only gets worse if you add something onto that in your mind, like my mother was right. I am the slug of the universe. No one will ever love me. See, that kind of thing. How many of you have ever bought oranges in a store? Can I see a show of hands? Almost everyone in the room. Now, how many of you ever bought every orange that was in the store? No hands. So you've all left oranges there. Do you think the oranges that you left there felt bad? Do you think they felt rejected? No, they didn't. Because they don't think like that. They know that someone else is going to come along and pick them, or they don't know anything. But the point is, they don't feel bad. See, you only feel bad when you talk to yourself after the event. Let's say I go up to Jim here and I say, you know, James, you are the biggest idiot of all the people I've ever met in my entire life. I've done workshops on 5 continents with over 100,000 people, maybe 500,000 people. You got to be the biggest jerk and idiot I've ever met. Now, how many people think that would raise James's self-esteem? Can I see a show of hands? Nobody raises their hands. How many people think that would make his self-esteem go down a little bit? Can I see a show of hands? About half the hands in the room go up. It's really a trick question, because it's not what I say to James that affects James' self-esteem. It's what James says to James when Jack stops talking. He could say, my God, the man's only known me about 20 minutes. How'd he figure it out so fast? Right? Which way would his self-esteem go then? Down, right. Or he could say, hey, Canfield just picked me because he looked around the room. He saw I'm the most handsome guy in the room. Couldn't keep his eyes off me. Had to call on me. He saw I have a great ego structure. I smile a lot. He knows I can take a little kidding. Which way would his self-esteem go then? Up. Or he might even say, you know, Canfield has a perceptual handicap. Should put him in a special ed class somewhere, you know, refer him to a specialist. I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt who once said, nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. See, it's not what people say to you. It's what you tell yourself when they stop talking. It's the meaning you make out of their talking to you. In other words, there's a lot of different responses, and what you respond is going to determine how you feel.
Probably one of the most common experiences that people have in life is the experience of rejection. You know, not everyone wants to date you, go out to dinner with you, hire you for a job, buy your product, and so forth. And it's a very common experience. It happens to kids when they're in school. They don't get picked to be on the baseball team, or they don't get picked to play kickball at the playground. And so what happens is, if we're going to have high self-esteem, we have to be able to handle that experience in a way that leaves us feeling good about ourselves. When I'm rejected, I might say something to myself like, well, they don't know me very well. Or I might say, maybe I'm not a great baseball player, but I'm a good tennis player. I always want to fill in the blank after that experience so I don't go into something like, they're right, I'm not a good baseball player, I'll never be good at athletics, no one likes me. A lot of people go into generalizing, you know, well, if they don't like me, nobody likes me. And when I'm working with clients, I often say, when they say, nobody likes me, I say, even the premier of China doesn't like you. And the idea there is that we each have lots of people in our life who like us. And so we have to remember to focus on the positive rather than the negative and fill in the blank in that space after I've been rejected. I often say to myself, if someone rejects me, well, there's something better in store for me. You know, there's something else I need to be doing right now. If these people don't buy my product, somebody else will. If they didn't buy my product, maybe it's because they really don't need it right now. It's not about the value of my tape or the value of my book. See, what happens is, if something happens to you, there's a vacuum in your mind. And if you don't fill that vacuum in with something positive, usually what will happen is you'll pull something in from the past that's negative. And so you can't just be neutral. You know that phrase, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me? I mean, that was a wise bit of folktale. When people say, you know, if you're starting to get angry, count to 10. Because when you're counting to 10, you can't be thinking about the thing you're angry about. At night, when people want to fall asleep and they say, count sheep. If you're going 1, 2, 3, 4, you're not sitting there worrying about the fact that, you know, they didn't like your proposal at work today. So it's really important when our mind is either starting to go negative or if it's just kind of quiet, to build in the positive so that we are in charge of creating the kind of response we want inside of ourselves that'll make us feel good.
I have a friend named Peggy Bassett. She's a minister of a church in Huntington Beach, California, and she also applied to be on the California Task Force for Self-Esteem, and she was not accepted. There were 450 applications for 25 places, the largest number of people that have ever applied for any state commission or task force in California. And I saw her at a party later, and I asked her how she felt about not being accepted, and she said, you know, I felt great about it. She said, I just said to myself, God must have something better in store for me. He wants me to be doing something else. I thought, what a neat thing to say to yourself instead of, oh, they don't want me or whatever it is. So it's really important that you start controlling your self-talk, if you will, and how you hold what happens to you. Tell me your first name again.
Sue.
Sue. If I go up to Sue and I say to you, Sue, you have green hair, would that upset you?
Not particularly.
Why not?
Because I know it's not true.
Because I know it's not true. Very good. See, if I come up to you, though, and I say, like, maybe you're the most selfish person in the world, and, you know, and you start to cave in, and then you go home and you say, Canfield really hurt my feelings. He told me, he's in front of all these people, he said I was the most selfish person in the world. And I feel really hurt. See, it's not what I said to Sue. See, if Sue gets upset about me saying she's selfish, it's because the doubt about her selfishness already existed inside of her before I ever opened my mouth. Because she didn't get upset when I said you have green hair, because she knows her hair is not green. And so in life, people don't make you feel bad. They don't upset you.
They simply say what they say. And if you do get upset, it's because inside of you the self-doubt already exists. See, if I call James over here selfish and he knows that he's not, he just knows that Canfield doesn't know him very well. Doesn't get upset by it. But if you get upset, remember, it's your responsibility. They didn't do it to you. I call it magical thinking, this thing where you think that other people can make you feel bad. And it comes from your parenting when you grow up. I remember my dad sending me to my room and saying, Jack, you go to your room and you think about what you said to your mother. You made her feel bad and I want you to think about it. And I went to my room and I thought, wow, I must be pretty powerful. If I can make my mom feel bad. And then I started thinking, well, if I can make people feel bad, they must be able to make me feel bad. But the truth is, again, people don't make you feel anything. It's what you tell yourself about it. The other thing about E plus R equals O is this word R also means risk. It means to risk a new behavior in response to the E and get a new outcome. Because if you keep doing the same behavior, you're going to keep getting what you always got. See, if you want change in your life, you've got to change your response to how life is. There's an old saying that says, if you keep on doing what you've always done, you'll keep on getting what you always got. I think it was Werner Erhard, the founder of the Yes Training, who said, the definition of insanity is continuing to repeat the same behavior and expecting a different result. You keep doing the same thing and expect somehow to get more intimate or more money or more successful. There are only three ways to grow in life. Stop doing what you've been doing that doesn't work. Start doing more of what you know that does work. And thirdly, try on things that you've never done before and see if they work or not. So what this seminar is about is awareness of what you do, plus risk-taking, trying on new behaviors, equals growth. You can't grow unless you're willing to risk. Winners are those people who make a habit out of doing the things losers are uncomfortable doing. Do a little experiment with me, unless you're driving your car as you're listening to this. Just fold your hands the way you normally fold them when you fold them in your lap. And notice which thumb you have on top, your right or your left. How many have your right thumb on top here? See, show of hands, about half of us. How many have your left thumb on top? Okay, the other half. Now, which is right? Left thumb on top or right thumb on top? Which is the correct way to do this? Doesn't matter, right? Okay, fold your hands again just like you had them. And now move all your fingers. Don't just move your thumb, but move all the fingers so the other thumb ends up on top. How does that feel? Different, strange, weird, uncomfortable, yucky, whatever it is. Remember what I said? Winners are those people who make a habit of doing the things losers are uncomfortable doing. In order to be successful in life, you have to change. You have to try on new responses. And it's going to feel uncomfortable. How many of you like to feel uncomfortable? No hands. I mean, if I threw a party and said, look, I'm having a party Saturday night, and I'm inviting you all, and the purpose of the party is to make everyone as uncomfortable as possible. Most people would not come. They go, forget it, Canfield. No way. See? But the reality is, in order to grow, you have to be willing to what? Be uncomfortable. You kind of have a little affirmation for yourself. I am comfortable being uncomfortable. You know, the weird thing is, if you were to hold your hand, fold your hand in this new position, after about 5 or 6 minutes, guess what? It would stop being uncomfortable. It would become comfortable. You get what's called a neuronal shift in the brain. And what's uncomfortable becomes comfortable, and you have to sustain through that.
All growth requires change, and all change requires discomfort, because if something's new, it's almost always uncomfortable, which means if I'm going to become a better salesperson, I might have to make cold calls I've never made before and risk rejection. I might have to go to parties and introduce myself to people so they know I'm available selling insurance or real estate. And if I've never done that before, usually it's uncomfortable. If it wasn't uncomfortable, I would have already done it. Talking to my kids in a vulnerable way, asking my wife for feedback, or even going to my boss and talking about my dissatisfaction with how I'm being managed. The discomfort usually is based on there's some fear. You know, I'm afraid of being rejected. I'm afraid of being hurt. I'm afraid of some kind of financial loss. And it's awkward. First time I gave a talk, it was very uncomfortable. You know, I'm trying to look at my notes and look at the audience and think about my speaking and my cadence and be funny and remember my points. And it was very difficult. I was nervous and uncomfortable. Now you give me a microphone, I won't shut up. You know, it's like I can't wait to get out there. I have a good time. I don't even think about it. So the nervous system, when it starts something new, it's integrating so many things at once and trying to balance it all out. After a while, it gets used to it. But there's that stage of discomfort. And if we let discomfort stop us from moving forward, then what happens is we never move because we're always stuck in what we call our comfort zone. And that zone of comfort becomes a habit, and it's easy. But if you want more, you have to do more. And as you do more, it's uncomfortable.